I want to welcome everybody to the Second Court of Appeals this afternoon. We have two cases set for oral argument, one at 1:30, one at 2:30. We'll be taking a break, short break in between. I understand that counsel for the first case have all checked in. Am I correctly understanding that nobody's going to be here for the appraisal review board? Yeah, have you heard?
My knowledge.
Okay. All right. So before we get started, I'll introduce the panel that we have. To my left is Justice Mike Wallach. To my right is Justice Dabney Basil, and I'm Elizabeth Kerr. So I'll ask the clerk to go ahead and call the case, please.
The court will now call Encore Electric Delivery Company versus Young Central Appraisal District and Young County Appraisal Review Board. May it please the court, Ms. Marnie McCormick will argue for the appellant, and Mr. Kurt Sweeney will argue for Young Central Appraisal District.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, and may it please the court. I'm Marnie McCormick here on behalf of Appellant Encore Electric Delivery Company. This appeal requires this court to decide one thing, and that is, does the district court have the power to consider the merits of Encore's motion to correct a clerical error on the Young County appraisal roll? The answer to that jurisdictional question is really pretty simple, despite the complexity in the briefs. The answer appears in clear tax code provisions that say a property owner has a right to judicial review of an ARB's decision on a motion to correct. The answer also appears in cases that confirm that courts have the power to consider whether an existing tax settlement actually bars a subsequent correction.
Isn't that seemingly limited to cases of just outright fraud?
No, Your Honor. I'll walk through some of the cases. The ones I'm talking about right now are actually cases under the tax code and not about traditional common law defenses. That's a separate standalone argument.
But before we even get there, as I understand it, the Supreme Court has requested a response to the petition for review in the Amarillo case, the Wilbarger case. So, and then you've got the diametrically opposed result out of the third court. So, what can we do differently than it seems like the universe of possibilities is kind of already set for the Supreme Court to be the decider on?
On that particular question, I don't think there is a third option. The answer is yes or no, and that question hopefully will get some guidance from the Texas Supreme Court on it, but in the meantime, we don't have any, and we don't know whether they're even going to grant one of the petitions. So we've made the argument in our brief, and I will address it here today. But just on the jurisdictional question and not the merits, I just want to point out that Encore's petition plainly seeks the very relief that the tax code says you can get through a suit for review of an ARB's decision on a motion to correct.
But what about Section 41.01B of the tax code? It says the board may not review or reject an agreement between a property owner or the owner's agent and the chief appraiser under Section 1.111E.
We don't dispute that, but Encore is not asking to change the agreement that Sherryland made in 2019. Encore is asking to change something else, an objective error on the appraisal roll that isn't reflected on the settlement agreement.
Wasn't a component of the valuation. That objective error didn't lead to the valuation value.
It didn't. The objective error is not part of the subjective issues that were settled.
What's subjective about this valuation?
Okay. So this valuation is because the property being Okay, the property spans multiple jurisdictions. And because of that, there isn't a single appraiser who goes out in Yonge County and appraises the transmission lines that are in Yonge County and takes into account all of the characteristics of those particular lines. That's what the district argues, but that's not how things work in a utility appraisal. In a utility appraisal, because the lines span multiple jurisdictions, they are appraised on a statewide basis using something called a unit appraisal, where the appraiser comes up with a number for the total value of the system and then allocates that number to categories of property statewide.
Isn't that objective data? And
no, that process is a subjective, there are a bunch of subjective decisions that are made in how to come up with the value and how to allocate it. To get to market value.
An appraiser makes those kind of decisions all the time. It doesn't mean it's a subjective. It doesn't mean it's a guess on the appraiser's part, does it?
Certainly not. There was a lot of work put into it.
So there is objective data.
I guess I'm trying to point out a distinction in what happens in this kind of appraisal. The subjective decisions are made. Those are valuation decisions. That's about what is the formula that we're going to use to come up with a market value for this property. That's separate. In a unit appraisal, that happens up if you were to think about it as a flow chart, in the top half. But once you come up with a market value for statewide transmission lines, then that value is allocated to individual jurisdictions using objective data. And that's where the error occurred in this case. But I'm getting way ahead of myself because
it's my fault that you are, but go ahead.
What I wanted to get out is that we are just here on jurisdiction. And what you and I were just discussing is a merits question.
It's a merits question unless we conclude that 41.01B covers this.
Well, but that's a merits question is whether
it's not a merits question according to the amicus. The amicus says review by the ARB is a prerequisite to judicial review.
The amicus brief contains a lot of factual errors that actually are not supported by the record.
Does it contain a legal error that
does
that
also
by the ARB?
It discusses merits issues, not jurisdictional issues. So, for example,
do you disagree with the premise that review by the ARB is a jurisdictional prerequisite to judicial review?
I agree that a decision by the ARB is a prerequisite to judicial review. I do not agree that.
And 41.01B deprives the ARB of the ability to make that decision.
No, 41.01B deprives the ARB of delving into the substance of the issue that was decided or settled. The ARB is not allowed to rejudge that issue. But there are cases that make clear that both the ARBs and courts have the jurisdiction to determine what does an existing agreement mean? What does it cover and what does it not? And
okay,
that's the question.
Let me ask you this question. If we assume that the settlement waiver of protest does cover the underlying issues that you're raising here, would 41.01B be a jurisdictional bar to your lawsuit?
If after a merits process that was the conclusion, then I would agree that Encore shouldn't recover. But I disagree that that decision needs to be made at this stage of the case. Right now, all we're talking about is should that issue even be considered? And
great.
That question has been answered by not only the tax code provisions that say a property owner is entitled to appeal an order of an ARB, determining a motion filed. That happened here. Then The appraisal district argues that just the mere existence of a settlement agreement erases that jurisdictional grant.
Wouldn't the tax code be a lot clearer if it said in 41 that notwithstanding Section 1.111 agreements?
There are lots of things that are unclear in the tax code, and it would be clearer.
I'll take judicial notice of that.
One which we can agree.
But I think I'm really not getting out what I need to get out. But on this issue, there are several decisions that confirm that courts have the power to determine the question that you are raising. What is the substance of the agreement? Does it bar what the claimant is seeking in a subsequent motion? One of those cases is Matagorda County. It's a Texas Supreme Court case where the court specifically says the preclusive effect of a tax settlement isn't a jurisdictional question. And the court went on to analyze this issue on the merits. And it did it again in 2018 in the Willacy County decision, where the court went to great lengths to address the preclusive effect of a tax settlement on, as it was a merits issue. And I'm not sure that you have it yet, but my opposing counsel is going to, has a handout that's one page out of that case. But there are a lot more pages in that case. And some of them address other common law or traditional contract offenses. And the court in Willacy County didn't just say that fraud is something you can consider. It also directed the lower court, the Court of Appeals, on remand to consider other defenses like estoppel and quasi-estoppel.
But and you want to shoehorn mutual mistake into that?
Well, in my view, there is no logical material distinction between the constellation of defenses.
Well, except that when Sherryland settled with the appraisal district, the expectation was this is the universe of numbers we're dealing with, and we agree that this is what it is, and we're fine and move on down the road.
So we absolutely disagree that that is actually what the settlement means. You can't discern that from the face of the settlement agreement. It's one page. It doesn't identify the property that was being appraised. It says that a protest is being settled, but it doesn't even say what the protest concerned.
The account number referenced in the settlement didn't reference the property at issue?
The account number by itself doesn't tell you anything. You have to go reference something outside the settlement agreement to even figure out what the account number references. And so this Encore hasn't had a chance to develop any of that, to point that out and say the settlement agreement on its face is ambiguous, and there is a universe of evidence. There's a lot of evidence that hasn't been able to be developed and presented to a court.
Well, as I understand it, and I do have a question about the summary judgment hearing at which the Duff and Phelps representative testified, which seems to make it not a summary judgment hearing. I don't know if it was an evidentiary plea to the jurisdiction hearing or what it really was, but anyway, there was testimony, and he explained his screw-up in transposing the numbers of different types of lines. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, what else do we need to know?
There's also evidence in the there are emails that are attached. Let me go back. Even though this issue, the jurisdictional issue, was presented in the context of a motion for summary judgment, it was just a jurisdictional argument. It wasn't a merits traditional motion for summary judgment. What they've asked for is a dismissal of the case, and that's what they got. They didn't get a decision on the merits. But there are emails in the record that show that the way this an appraisal happens in this circumstance is the parties actually agree on a number before the appraisal report is even put together. And the appraisal report that you have is supposed to reflect what the parties agreed on for market value for the system and the transmission lines. And the parties haven't been able to fully develop all of that.
But isn't it, I mean, it works. Okay, but if Duff and Phelps had done it right, would we be here today?
Duff and Phelps.
The ones had, who transport, yeah.
If they had correctly conveyed the mileages and not transposed the numbers, then I would assume not. Right. But that error.
Well, did, and this is.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I just had a question for my own curiosity. It's not on the record, I guess, but I did all this get straightened out in 2020 and beyond?
I can't answer that.
Okay.
I don't know that. It's not in the record.
Okay.
Since the review board made an appearance on the day that the judgment was signed, how do we have a final judgment here?
Well, there are some indications, and there's some confusion when you read the judgment on its face because it refers to a single defendant and a single motion. But at the end, it denies plaintiff Encore any relief at all, and it says it disposes of all parties and all issues herein and is final and appealable, and for that reason, Encore treated it as a final judgment.
Well, yeah, Encore may have treated it that way, but the question is, do you have any authority that tells us that when something like this happens, when someone enters an appearance in a case on the same day without knowing time-wise to the minute, you know, how are we supposed to decide whether or not there was, in fact, a disposition of all parties?
I see my time has expired. May I answer?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Well, you look at there's a Lehrman case, and you can sometimes apply presumptions. You can't apply a presumption here because there was no trial and there were multiple parties in the case. So you just have to determine what the court's intent was, and it's pretty clear that the court intended to dispose of the entire case. And a court has the power to do that on a jurisdictional basis, sua sponte. It didn't even need the ARB to be in the case or to have appeared in the case to make up its own mind that there was no jurisdiction.
Yeah, I'm going to ask you one quick question, even though your time is up. Why did the ARB file its answer so late? Had it not been served at the same time as the appraisal district?
I cannot answer that either.
Okay.
Sorry.
All right. Thank you.
Okay.
Please the court, your honors. My name is Kirk Swinney. I'm here on behalf of the Young Central Appraisal District. I'm joined by Chief Appraiser Jesse Blackman and some of his staff in the audience. Your honors, this case is about whether agreements voluntarily entered between parties and which the legislature has made non-reviewable will in fact be enforced. It's about whether the explicit words of a statute, in this case section 1.111E, there's way too many ones in that statute, will in fact be enforced, or there will be judicial carve-outs from the plain and clear reading of the statute that says that agreement is final. I'm sure I need not remind your honors that settlement agreements are highly favored in the law. They enable the resolution of both business and governmental affairs. As the Supreme Court has opined, parties should be held to their word. Quote, parties should not sign contracts while crossing their fingers behind their backs. Forrest Oil versus McGowan, cited in the brief. In this particular case, there are in this particular set of facts and law, there are multiple cases which hold that this is a jurisdictional issue.
Before we get started on that, let's talk about the kind of the predicate question, which is, why do we have a final judgment here?
The judgment specifically says it disposes of all claims and parties. In this case, as the Amarillo court held in the Wilbarger case, it really doesn't matter what the ARB is or whether they were proper parties. The same issue resolves the whole of the case. Pardon me, I've got a little bit of raspy voice here. In that particular case, the ARB did not meaningfully participate, though they did file an answer more timely in this case, but in the Wilbarger case. But the bottom line is the issue is the same. The issue disposed of the entirety of the case and the parties. What happens every year? Appraisal district sends out a notice of appraised value. Property owners may protest. Very often, especially with industrial large-scale properties, the owner and the appraisal district reaching some sort of agreement ahead of time. And that's what happened in this case. Those agreements are specifically authorized in this 1.111E, which says an agreement between a property owner or the owner's agent and the chief appraiser is final if it relates to a matter, subsection 2, which may be corrected under section 2525. Either this is entirely not an appropriate case because it's not correctable under section 2525, or that judgment or that settlement agreement is final. It's not a pick and choose situation here. This was a 2525C motion. Charlie, as mentioned, several cases, and they're all cited in the brief, held that these agreements are not reviewable and mostly on jurisdictional grounds. When, and as I believe Justice Basil mentioned, it's the 4101B argument that if an appraisal review board can't review it, then there's no jurisdiction under 42.21 to go to district court. Now, honestly, Justice, I'm kind of not going down that trail because there's lots of things we could talk about that pro and con on that, and I'll get into it if you like. But I would suggest that the crux of Encore's argument and the crux of the decision in the Mills case, the only case to hold otherwise under these circumstances, is that the Willacy case versus Willacy CAD versus Sebastian Green carves out this new exception to the 1.111E agreements. I submit, and the language of Willacy will hold out. It's regretful Ms. Hargrove's not here. She argued that case. Carves out an exception for fraud and fraud only. The facts, as I mentioned in the brief, of the Willacy case are just egregious in the extreme. Sebastian pulled off a deliberate fraud against the Willacy CAD. It said, we don't own that grain. DeBruce owns it. Here, sign an agreement that says we don't own it, which they did. And it turns out DeBruce didn't own it. Sebastian owned it. And then they come back and say, King's X, you can't touch us. We signed an agreement. Well, of course, no court's going to allow that. The Supreme Court opined a statute that rewards fraud with finality and non-reviewability violates both the legislature's intent in streamlining the dispute resolution process and any notion of sound public policy.
So why would mutual mistake be any different?
Mutual mistake is fundamentally different than fraud. Nobody can contest that there was fraud here. Nobody defrauded the other deliberately here. If mutual mistake is an exception, then those agreements are reviewable.
So what is the distinction between fraud and mutual mistake regarding the reviewability?
Fundamentally, it's been this way since the Beck and Mastin decision. I don't have that side at the tip of my tongue. But an appraisal created on the basis of fraud is no appraisal at all. It's, quote, void ab initio, unquote. And therefore, it's like we're starting over.
So is that contract entered into a mutual mistake, is it void or voidable?
I don't think it's either. If you're talking about a contract, obviously we're talking about contract law. It can be voidable. But this is not a contract per se. It is a statutory agreement. And whether the mistake was mutual or not, I mean, it may have been. Sherry Land reported the wrong information, and Young CAD took it at face value. And the agreement was made. I mean, is that a mutual mistake? It's certainly a mistake on one side, and I'm sure it was accepted by the other side. But again, if any mistake like that goes to the value is the subject of voiding those agreements are frail indeed and, in fact, are not final. We go on that the Supreme Court goes on and repeatedly recognizes that these are not contracts, and yet it holds that, quote, some. That's a critical distinction. It doesn't say all, but some basic contract principles apply. A contract is subject to avoidance on the ground of fraudulent inducement. It does not go on to say, then, that these statutory agreements can be voided on the basis of mutual mistake or any other contract.
Well, doesn't Encore cite some cases where the terms fraud and mutual mistake are used together?
I don't think any of those cases hold them to be equivalent. I mean, I think those are very radically different concepts. In this case, you know, like Sebastian Grain, just as the same with Beck and Maston, it's an old Houston case, one party knowingly deceived the other. And therefore, you say, in that case, yeah, we're going to have an exception. I think that's just at the gut level, it's a fundamentally different thing than, oops, we made a mistake. If oops, we made a mistake is the ground for mutual mistake, then any number of things. Now they can come back and say, oh, did we tell you those towers were 80 feet tall? They're really only 75 feet tall. I guess we made a mistake, you know, let's undo this. Oh, did we tell you our average line age was 5 years? We meant 50 years. Oops, we made a mistake. Those agreements are now subject to just any type of revocation simply because somebody made a mistake. Well, nobody wants out of a contract until they discover something was bad about it. Similar thing, if no one wants out of these statutory agreements until they decide something went wrong about it. But the purpose of 1.111E is to make these things final, as the words say. By this time, the tax bills have been sent. The taxes were paid, the teachers were paid, the roads were paved, the courts were open, the deputies were dispatched, etc. And it's not time to come back and say, King's X, I made a mistake in reporting to you. If the legislature meant that to happen, the legislature could have made that exception. In fact, the legislature has now come back and made an exception under different fact circumstances, not under this, but it's embodied in C-1, which was not in effect at the time, but 2525C-1. Encore argues that 1.111E's agreements are final as to D and C-1, but not C. That defies the various broad language of the statute, which just says it's final if it can be corrected under a 2525 motion. It doesn't say C, doesn't say D, doesn't say D-1, doesn't say C-1. It says 25.25, which facially encompasses the whole of section 25.25. To hold otherwise would be to hold that C-1 and D implicitly repeal in part 1.111E, and that is contrary to the rules of statutory interpretation unless the statute explicitly so repeals. These things can clearly be read harmoniously. To some extent, we've already covered, but Encore argues that this agreement didn't cover the line size. Well, and this is in the illustrations, but the protest was over value of two accounts. The settlement was over value of two accounts. Did the line sizes go into making up that value? Well, sure they did. So did the age of the lines. So did the height of the tower. So did the condition of the tower. How specific do these agreements need to be in order to be enforceable? I submit they need to be specific as to value. All other matters are simply component parts of value. Let me address the jurisdiction versus no remedy argument. I agree, Your Honor, that I'm not sure what that hearing was after testimony was allowed in a summary judgment hearing. The summary judgment below did not limit itself to jurisdiction. It argued no remedy here. And it did mention jurisdiction, don't get me wrong. The judgment in question does not limit itself to jurisdiction. It says no relief. Now, obviously, as we discussed a moment ago, Justice Basil, you raised, the argument for jurisdiction is a strong one under 41.01B. No ARB review, no jurisdiction under 42.21. I realize I'm rattling a bunch of tax code sections. You got to realize I've been living this for the last 35 years. But I submit it frankly doesn't matter. If an agreement is final, what does it matter whether that's jurisdiction or there's just no relief? Either way you look at it, there's no relief. because these agreements are final. And as far as the Matagorda case, Matagorda versus Coastal was argued by one of my...
Counsel, if you're refreshed by recollection, did anyone object to the taking of oral testimony?
I did.
Okay.
I argued the hearing. Yes, sir, I did object. My objection was overruled.
Court overruled it?
Correct. If I recall, and I've argued several ways, I argued the Will Barker case too. Sometimes they start running together in my mind. If I recall, the judge rules, just for purposes of this hearing, we're going to hear the testimony. So, I don't know what that means, honestly. I truly don't. Do you,
before you move on to your next point, do you agree that there's no nuanced or third sort of decision that we could reach in this case that would make the Supreme Court look at all of this differently?
I agree with that, Your Honor. I mean, the only thing, and I think I mentioned this in the brief, and as my opposing counsel, I don't know whether the Supreme Court's going to take either Mills or Will Barker. The decision of yet another court may weigh on the Supreme Court's decision. Yeah, obviously, if I knew the minds of the Supreme Court, I'd be in a different business.
Well, so I recall the petition for review noted that we've got this case.
Correct. Yes, that is true.
Not that the Supreme Court is waiting with bated breath to hear our opinion.
Well, I'm not sure, Your Honor. I think sometimes the Supreme Court does wait on several courts of appeal to come down, especially when there's a conflict. And I couldn't quote you a case right now, but
it's
decisions of the Supreme Court that said, well, our courts of appeals upheld this and this and that and so on.
We're noted tax experts here.
Well, your questions have been insightful. I only have one other point, and it's self-evident. The parties made a deal. It's unfortunate that Encore regrets that deal. It's unfortunate that somebody made a mistake. And I'll say that, the gentleman who made a mistake was my neighbor for 26 years. We were co-conspirators in neighborhood associations together. The justice who authored the Mills opinion, I consider a personal friend. I don't mean to disparage anyone here. But a deal is a deal is a deal. If, in fact, Encore had later discovered some mistake that made the deal more advantageous to it than ought to be, I truly doubt this matter would have ever come up. But it's done. We have to move forward, and the law favors settlement agreements for a reason, and the specific statute makes these things final for a reason. Thank you very much, Your Honors.
Thank you. Rebuttal.
Thank you. I first want to address the policy considerations that opposing counsel raised. Basically, the district argues that it's a bad idea to let property owners make these kinds of challenges because taxing authorities have already spent money in paved roads and paid people.
I hate to interrupt, because a point that was just made by opposing counsel was that the motion for summary judgment was broader than just jurisdiction. Do you agree or disagree with that?
I disagree with that. I just want the court to understand that the legislature has actually already decided to put that it's so important to correct certain types of errors, just certain types, not all errors. We're not opening the floodgates. We're just talking about a clerical error. And the legislature has decided that that type of error can be corrected for up to 5 years, even if it wasn't protested in the year that the tax was levied.
How is this particular error a clerical error?
Because it is a mistake in the writing, calculating, and computing. And that is how the tax code defines a clerical error. And a clerical error is an objective error. It's a numerical error. It was a transposed number thing. We're not talking about the formula that's used to come up with value. That is a subjective issue that is not a clerical error. And we are not, Encore is not seeking to challenge the formula that was used to appraise property. It's just seeking to correct an objective error that qualifies as a clerical error. Again, that's a merits issue. You don't even have to decide that.
Let's say the shoe is on the other foot, and the mistake favored Encore, and somehow the appraisal district realized that later. Would it have had any remedy?
There is a provision in Section 2525 that allows appraisal districts to initiate or correct a clerical error, but I'm not an expert on that particular provision, so I don't want to possibly, but it's not the language that we're relying on, which is
sure.
Subsection C, subsection 1.
Right.
I keep hearing the district say a deal's a deal. What I can't, the problem here is the record doesn't show what the deal was because Encore hasn't had a chance to actually litigate the issue. Appraisal districts under the provision that Justice Basil pointed out very early in the argument, appraisal districts don't have power to rejudge something that was settled, but they do have power to adjudicate something that wasn't already settled. And the problem here is they're shutting it down before we even get to analyze what was settled and what was not. And that is not a jurisdictional issue. It is a merits issue. That's the answer to the question of whether Encore should prevail.
Well, their argument is that the settlement waiver of protest has value, and every issue that's subsumed within the word value was settled.
I agree that's their argument, but I don't believe that's what the statutes don't tell you that that's how it's supposed to work. There's nothing in the statute that precludes an ARB or a court from correcting a clerical error in appraisal records, even on a settlement agreement, for that matter. If it's truly a clerical error, it's correctable. But the problem here is the court is refusing to even go through the process of figuring out what was settled and what wasn't. And that's the right that Encore seeks to enforce in this appeal, is just a right to go through the process and get a merits decision from the trial court. And so we would respectfully request that the court reverse the trial court's order and send the case back for merits proceedings.
Thank you very much. Any more questions?
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. We appreciate the oral argument. It's been very helpful. And your case is submitted. We're going to take a quick break before our 2:30. Thank you.
Thanks to both of you.
All right.